Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
VOA correspondent traveling with Obama, and Afghan Taliban releases video of U.S. prisoner handover. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez, traveling with President Barack Obama, talked about the U.S. leader's dramatic speech Wednesday in the Polish capital.
From Warsaw, the president is flying to Brussels for the G7. The biggest news of that meeting at this moment is the fact that it's not the G8. Russia will not be there. Their invitation was revoked. The meeting was supposed to be held in Sochi, but in protest, Russia's annexation of Crimea, that invitation no longer is. The meeting taking place in Brussels instead.
That was VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez, who is traveling with the president in Europe. The Afghan Taliban has released a video showing its fighters handing over captured American soldier Bowie Bergdahl to the U.S. military in an eastern province that borders Pakistan Saturday. Ayaz Ghul gives details from Pakistan, where the American soldier is believed to have spent most of his time since the Taliban captured him nearly 5 years ago.
The Taliban video shows U.S. Army Sergeant Bergdahl waiting in a white pickup truck surrounded by heavily armed Taliban fighters. As a commentator narrates the events, a clean-shaven Bergdahl is seen with a close-cropped haircut, wearing a white shalwar kameez, the traditional Afghan clothing. He blinks frequently as he looks at and listens to his captors. As Black Hawk helicopters circle overhead, one lands nearby and the captive soldier is then led to his rescuers by two men, one taking Bergdahl by the hand as the other waves a white flag. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A suspected suicide bomber has detonated explosives near a military vehicle, killing 5 people near the Pakistani capital. Officials say 2 military officers are among those killed in the Wednesday attack in the garrison city of Rawalpindi. Investigators say the 3 other victims were civilians. There were no immediate claims of responsibility, but local officials blame the Taliban. Tens of thousands of people have turned out in Hong Kong for a vigil marking the 25th anniversary of the bloody crackdown on protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Sea of candles lit the massive Victoria Park late Wednesday as throngs gathered to sing songs and listen to speeches, marking the massacre that ended the 1989 pro-democracy movement in China. Ren Zhe, an activist taking part in the vigil, says it is crucial that Beijing know Hong Kong supports democratic freedoms and opposes violence.
We understand the importance of fighting for the democracy of the China because Hong Kong is a part of China. And nowadays, the political reforms are now opposed by the Communist Party. They are trying to elect a chief executive that is only response to the mainland China government.
Situation was much quieter in Beijing Wednesday, and security was tight on Tiananmen Square. Hundreds of Chinese officers checked identifications and kept journalists from reporting in the square. Beijing allows no public discussion of the 1989 massacre, in which soldiers killed hundreds, if not thousands, of unarmed protesters. The United States is calling on Egypt's president-elect Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to carry out reforms to ensure the government is accountable and transparent while protecting the universal rights of all Egyptians. A White House statement Wednesday says President Barack Obama plans to speak with Sisi in the coming days. Following the official announcement, the former army chief won 97% of the vote in last week's election. Exit polls from South Korea's local election showed a close race Wednesday between the Conservative Party of President Park Geun-hye and opposition candidates. The elections are seen as a key test for President Park, whose popularity has declined sharply because of public outrage over her response to a deadly ferry disaster. Ms. Park has repeatedly apologized for the April 16 sinking of the Sewol ferry, which killed 300 people, mostly high school students, and prompted an outpouring of public anger. And a new poll shows that the vast majority of Ukrainians feel that no outside country has a right to be involved in decisions about their country's future. The U.S.-based Gallup poll said its April survey of 1,400 Ukrainians outside of the Crimean Peninsula showed 78% outside to interference. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA. Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Doctors Without Borders says the ongoing Ebola outbreak is resurging in Guinea and neighboring Sierra Leone. The virus has killed about 2,200 people since it appeared in southeastern Guinea in February.
That's VOA's Anne Look reporting from Dakar. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the Obama administration is calling on newly elected Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to carry out much-needed government reforms. And the U.S. is investing more than $1 billion to create about 20 million new electricity connections in sub-Saharan Africa.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Benin, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
In Libya, a spokesman for Khalifa Haftar says the former army chief was not hurt in a suicide bombing today at his home in Benghazi, but four others died in the attack and three were wounded. Among the wounded is Libyan Air Force Chief of Staff Saktar al-Garushi. No word on his condition. The bomber detonated the high explosives at the general's front gate. Haftar served as army chief under the late ruler Muammar Gaddafi. He recently gained support from Libyan military units in a three-week military campaign against Ansar al-Sharia and other militant Islamists in eastern Libya. 18 died in clashes in Benghazi yesterday. Meanwhile, the Libyan government remains in chaos. The General National Congress is divided between Islamist and non-Islamist. Their newly appointed Prime Minister, Ahmed Maiteg, held his first cabinet meeting yesterday under armed guard, while his predecessor, Abdullah Al-Tini, refused to relinquish power.
Doctors Without Borders says the ongoing Ebola outbreak is resurging in Guinea and neighboring Sierra Leone. The virus has killed about 200 people since it appeared in southeastern Guinea in February. Health workers appear to be making progress against the outbreak, but Guinea and Sierra Leone are now reporting fresh cases, some of them in areas previously unaffected by the disease. VOA's Anne Look has more from Dakar.
Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, says it has seen more than 20 new cases of Ebola at its treatment centers in Guinea since last week alone. The total number of suspected new cases is believed to be higher. MSF says areas like the capital, Conakry, and the towns of Gwekweju in Masenta, near the border with Liberia, have seen a spike in the number of new patients. But Ebola is also cropping up in previously untouched towns, like Telemele, just north of the capital, and the coastal town of Bofa. MSF Director of Operations Bart Janssens says this geographical spread is a problem.
It clearly indicates that the epidemic is not at all under control, as we might have hoped sort of 1 or 2 weeks ago when we really saw cases continually going down over time.
He says people should seek treatment as soon as they show symptoms or if they believe they have been exposed. The Ebola virus is spread through direct contact with the bodily fluids of an infected person, and the virus can be transmitted even after that person dies. Health workers say families moving bodies for funerals have been a factor in the spread of the disease. It can take up to 3 weeks for symptoms to appear. The symptoms include fever, vomiting, body aches, and uncontrollable bleeding. There is no cure. Health workers try to isolate suspected cases. MSF's Janssen says some people do recover with medical care.
People are afraid to come out and that it's difficult to identify all cases and also to track the contacts of these cases. These people travel through other sites, either because they do not know they're sick or either because they want to get away from places where they can be identified.
The ongoing outbreak in West Africa has had about a 70% fatality rate. Those who have survived, as well as relatives of those who have died, report being stigmatized by their communities. The outbreak spread into border areas of Liberia and Sierra Leone in April. Liberia has not reported any new cases in a month. That is not the case for Sierra Leone. MSF says it is setting up a new clinic there in the town of Kwandu, near the border with Guinea. One person confirmed to have Ebola and three others suspected of having the disease died in Kwandu this week. Sierra Leone's health ministry had reported 18 possible new cases there at the end of May. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
A government crackdown on Muslim militants in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa is making the work of human rights advocates and moderate Muslim clerics more difficult as they face danger both from security forces and radical youths. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
In March, two gunmen stormed a church in Mombasa's Likoni neighborhood and opened fire, killing four worshippers and injuring 15 others. Days later, City Commissioner Nelson Marua called for his officers to execute terror suspects behind the church attack and those roaming in the streets targeting innocent people. The commissioner was condemned by human rights campaigners who also called for his resignation. A week later, the commissioner said he was putting the campaigners on notice as they planned to protest the killing of controversial cleric Abu Bakar Sharif Ahmed, also known as Makaburi. Khalid Hussein is the head of Haki Africa, a rights group, whose name in Swahili means justice. He says security officials should not vent their anger and frustrations at human rights campaigners.
We feel that the government is under a lot of pressure, and understandably so, because security of any kind, insecurity of this nature, would put anyone under frustration. But we get very, very concerned when the government authorities take it out on civil society groups that are actually trying to help.
Mombasa has witnessed a wave of terror attacks and killing of suspected terror suspects. Fingers are being pointed at security officers, an accusation strongly denied by the government. As the threat and attacks increase, Hussein says it is becoming dangerous for rights activists to walk in the streets.
Even as human rights activists, we face threats almost on a daily basis because from government or officers, sometimes communities that feel we need to do more. Sometimes we get, people asking us to come out more firmly and demand that justice be done. But when we tell them that, the wheels of justice move in their own pace, they don't get satisfied.
Some Muslim communities in Mombasa have been angered by radical youths taking over two influential mosques in the Majengo neighborhood. Late last year, hundreds of Muslim youths armed with knives invaded Sakina Mosque and ejected the clerics, holding the mosque under siege for more than 2 hours. The day of the attack, the Council of Imams and Preachers Chairman, Sheikh Mohammed Idris, was in the mosque giving summons, as he has for the past 35 years. Idris notes 6 months later the same youth still call the clerics names and accuse them of working with the government to oppress the Muslim community. He says the clerics were not competing with the youths in any way, do not insult them or talk bad about them, but they call the clerics bad names in the streets. Idris says the youths call the clerics hypocrites and call the Council of Imams and Preachers the Satan organization. 3 years ago, the CIPK and other Muslim organizations convened an Islamic conference to bring together top scholars to discuss where the fighting in neighbouring Somalia between militants group Al-Shabaab and the Somali government was a holy war. The scholars agreed there was no holy war in Somalia, and some clerics like Idris believe that conclusion might have angered the youths and supporters of Al-Shabaab. Sheikh Idris says that since he left the mosque, all the summons are about jihad and how radical Muslims are treated by the government, nothing else.
Wallahi, that's ambazo zinazotoka pale, kila mmoja anasikia.
He says the summons are all about jihad and how the government is against and oppresses radicals. But Idris says when something goes wrong, it is important for people to sit, look at it very keenly, and call on people who are well educated and understand the topic at hand. He asks if what is happening now continues, who will listen to whom? Kenya has troops in Somalia fighting Al-Shabaab. The Al-Qaeda link group claimed responsibility for last year's assault on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, in which more than 60 people were killed. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Mombasa.
A rights group says park rangers and environmental activists in the DRC are receiving death threats after criticizing plans for oil exploration. Human Rights Watch says a British firm plans to explore for petroleum near and within Virunga National Park. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
Virunga National Park has been declared a World Heritage Site by the United Nations, which says such sites belong to all the peoples of the world, irrespective of the territory on which they're located. Virunga also is home to many of the last mountain gorillas. The British oil firm Soko International is currently operating in eastern Congo, which has been plagued for decades by violence and conflict. Ida Sawyer says testimony about the alleged threats is being collected.
Human Rights Watch has documented numerous cases of Virunga Park rangers and human rights activists and environmental activists who have been threatened, arbitrarily arrested, or attacked after criticizing plans to explore for oil in the park.
Sawyer is Human Rights Watch's senior Congo researcher based in Kinshasa.
We've called on Congolese authorities to investigate these acts of violence and intimidation and to ensure that both the park rangers and the activists can express their views freely without risking their lives.
She says there are also many allegations of government officials receiving bribes. Sawyer says many of the rangers and activists believe oil exploration would harm Virunga National Park and the wildlife, as well as communities near the park.
However, many Congolese government officials support this exploration because of the potential financial gains oil could bring.
She says it's difficult to trace the origins of many of the threats, but says some, including death threats, allegedly were made at meetings with government officials or employees of the government's Institute for the Park. The DRC government has not yet responded to the Human Rights Watch report, but Soko International has. The group presented its findings to Soko prior to their release to the media.
They sent us a written response, and they did deny any role in the threats, the violence, or bribery. They said they would look into the allegations of bribery in particular, according to their procedures and their code of ethics, and they did condemn the use of violence and intimidation.
The company wrote that there have been a number of false and inaccurate allegations leveled against Soko International in recent years, particularly in the last month. It blames them on what it calls false, distorted, and/or exaggerated accounts of Soko activities in the DRC. It says those involved in alleged criminal activity have been branded Soko representatives, when simply they are not and have nothing to do with the company. Human Rights Watch has urged the British government to investigate allegations of attempted bribes of park rangers, activists, and officials. On April 15th, unknown gunmen shot and seriously wounded Virunga Park director Emmanuel de Merode, a Belgian national. Military and justice officials are investigating. No arrests have been made so far. Human Rights Watch has also asked the Belgian government to investigate.
Soon after that attack, a number of environmental and human rights activists who've done a lot of work on the park received threats.
She says those threats referred to the attack on de Merode. She quotes one as saying, "Don't believe that just because we failed to get your director, that we are going to fail to get you." Human Rights Watch says it also met with the governor of North Kivu State, Julian Paluku, who told the group that some government and security officials had been, quote, manipulated. However, he said he did not know who was behind it. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Doctors Without Borders say the ongoing Ebola outbreak is resurging in Guinea and neighboring Sierra Leone. The Obama administration is calling on newly elected Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to carry out much-needed government reforms. And the U.S. government is investing more than $1 billion to create about 20 million new electricity connections in sub-Saharan Africa, and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The Obama administration is calling on newly elected Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to carry out much-needed government reforms to protect the rights of its more than 86 million citizens. A White House statement released today said President Obama plans to talk with Mr. Sisi in the coming days and expressed his concern about the restrictive political environment during Egypt's election. Global reaction from other leaders was cautiously hopeful. A UN statement said Secretary General Ban Ki-moon trusts that the president-elect will do everything possible to support the people's aspirations for a stable, democratic, and prosperous Egypt. Saudi Arabia was more enthusiastic. The official daily newspaper Al Arabiya said King Abdullah congratulated Mr. al-Sisi and described the former Egyptian general's election as a historic day. King Abdullah is believed to be talking with the United Arab Emirates about offering a $20 billion aid package for Mr. Sisi's new government.
African coffee producers meeting in Cameroon are trying to reverse a long-term drop in production. Climate change, lack of government investment, and other factors have caused coffee production to drop as much as 70% in some countries over time. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Today, Africa contributes barely 10% of world coffee production, down from 40% in the 1980s. Cameroonian coffee exporter Buenda Arbet says the nosedive started when falling world prices and the economic crisis of the late 1980s and the early 90s made African governments stop giving financial assistance and training to coffee farmers.
Who are those involved in coffee production? You'll find out that they are the peasant farmers. And these are people who are not very knowledgeable with regard to what is happening in the international market. The government says we're no longer going to buy farm inputs for you. These are assignments that were carried out by the state. There was no transition in terms of bringing up the farmer, the peasant farmer, to be able to understand what it takes to sell on the international market.
The slump is also a result of changes in climate patterns, aging farms and farmers, and the fact that many countries started abandoning coffee production when they discovered petroleum and other mineral resources. Economist analyst Roger Betala tells VOA that tens of millions of Africans who made their livelihood through coffee production lost their jobs.
Lorsque le café a des problèmes, tous les intermédiaires, les torréfacteurs, les transporteurs.
He says when there is a problem with coffee, so many people on the production chain, like farmers and their laborers and transporters, suffer. He adds that a serious problem crops up when states cannot convert the unemployed workforce after drastic drops in coffee production, and consequently, the outcome is prejudicial. Betala says the drop in exports and rise in unemployment damaged some countries' economies.
Au Cameroun, par exemple, le café entrait dans la constitution du produit intérieur brut autour de 15-20%.
He says in Cameroon, coffee contributed up to 30% of the gross domestic product, but today contributes only 1%. The meeting in Yaoundé aimed to map out ways of increasing coffee production by at least 50% in the next 2 years. Central African Economic and Monetary Community Agriculture Program researcher Bedimo Joseph says Africa must work with coffee production giants like Brazil, which today accounts for a third of the world's coffee production.
Nous avons dans nos collections, par exemple, quand je voudrais parler des collections de café arabica.
He says his program has 217 genotypes of Arabica coffee and are working with Brazilian and French researchers to improve coffee varieties to increase yields. John Schulter is with the non-governmental organization Coffee Africa. He says producers like Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Uganda, Ethiopia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo can attain the hoped-for results.
I have the conviction that African coffee is going to be one of the keys to the future supply of coffee to a world market which is drinking more and more coffee globally. According to the International Coffee Organization, there's going to be a gap in between the demand for coffee in 10 years' time and the supply. And Africa, with its potential to produce more coffee to get back to where it was 10, 20 years ago, has the potential to meet that gap.
Producers hope that research will improve crops, fertilizers, and soil. They also plan to encourage young people to take up coffee farming and will ask governments to increase assistance. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Guinea-Bissau's former chief of the Navy reportedly secretly pleaded guilty yesterday to charges he conspired to import 11 pounds of cocaine to the United States. Reuters says the report is based on sources in U.S. Southern District Court of New York. Jose Americo Buba Nachutu was arrested with four others in an April 2013 sting operation conducted by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. Those arrested included Guinea-Bissau's chief of the armed forces, Antonio Njai. The arrests were made aboard a luxury yacht off the coast of Guinea-Bissau. Njai, who led a coup that disrupted the nation's 2012 elections, denied running drugs and avoided arrest by refusing to go ashore. U.S. authorities described Nachutu as a kingpin in West Africa's illegal drug trade. He faces a life sentence. The U.S. charges filed last year link Nachutu and Njai to trafficking in cocaine from Colombia and surface-to-air missiles destined for the paramilitary forces in Colombia known as FARC.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Going on, what's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globalists. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of The Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront at voanews.com.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica at voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Doctors Without Borders says the ongoing Ebola outbreak is resurging in Guinea and neighboring Sierra Leone. The Obama administration calls on newly elected Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to carry out much-needed government reforms. And the U.S. government is investing more than $1 billion to create about 20 million new electricity connections in sub-Saharan Africa. Coming up, we'll have music from Benin and our feature series on poaching in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Buhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim, and welcome back.
Thank you very much, Sunny. And I understand you have lots of World Cup football news for us today.
Kim, we're now only 8 days away to the kickoff of the Football World Cup in Brazil.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
Didier Drogba and the Elephants of Ivory Coast, Africa's highest-ranked team, are in the southwestern U.S. state of Texas this evening for a friendly World Cup warm-up match against El Salvador. The game will be played at Toyota Stadium, the home venue for Major League Soccer's FC Dallas club. Ivory Coast is making its third consecutive World Cup appearance, and the Elephants are hoping to advance to the knockout rounds in Brazil for the first time. Ivory Coast is grouped with Colombia, Greece, and Japan for the first round of the World Cup. The Ivorians will kick off their World Cup campaign June 14th when they play Japan in Recife, Brazil. Then they'll play Colombia June 19th in Brasilia and wrap up group play June 24th when they go against Greece in Fortaleza, Brazil. The Greeks played a scoreless draw against African champion Nigeria Tuesday night in another World Cup warm-up match held in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. There were few scoring chances in the match. One of Nigeria's best opportunities came late in the friendly international in the 87th minute when Ogenyi Onazi fired a 23-meter shot that was saved by Greek goalkeeper Stefanos Kapino. Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, Africa's five World Cup-bound teams, Algeria, Cameroon, Ghana, Nigeria, and Ivory Coast, busy with their preparations for Brazil. A reminder for our VOA football fans, the World Cup's opening match will be June 12th when Brazil will host Croatia in Sao Paulo. David, talk a bit about the preparations by the five African teams.
Yes, Sonny, the preparations are continuing. And you may recall way back in March, I said at the time that I was very happy that if Cameroon were going to get a 5-1 pasting, they did from Portugal, that it happened in March and not in the middle of June during the World Cup. And I think the proof of that came to me, Sonny, with a very good performance by the Indomitable Lions against Germany. They forced a 2-2 draw. And what that indicates to me is that Cameroon took on board the lessons from that hammering in Portugal, and they have improved considerably. Now, Cameroon, of course, in the World Cup, they're in the same group as Brazil, Croatia, and Mexico. And my reading of this group is that Brazil will win it. I think they'll win all three matches. And then you're going to get a real battle for second place. I don't think there's an awful lot between Croatia, Cameroon, and Mexico. I think on their day, all are good enough to finish runners-up. So in that sense, Sonny, an encouraging result. It is a warm-up match, and we have stressed on the sunny side of sport not to read too much into these friendly games. They are, after all, for many of the coaches, almost like experimental laboratories. They're trying out different combinations. So I don't believe the result is as crucial as it will be during the World Cup when, of course, the difference between a draw and a victory can be the difference between staying in the tournament and going home after the first round. But I had a feeling Germany would win this game. I thought it would be a fairly narrow victory, but I was really encouraged by the fact that Cameroon got that 2-2 draw in Mönchengladbach in Germany. So well done, the Indomitable Lions. A team that's going very quietly about their business are the Desert Foxes of Algeria. Very quiet, no commotions, no sensational stories coming out of their camp. And they started their countdown with a 3-1 victory over Armenia. Now, Armenia are by no means a powerhouse in European football, but nevertheless, a good win for the Algerians. Maybe they're going to surprise us yet, Sonny, because they're in the same group as Russia, Belgium, and South Korea. And the general feeling, looking at the comments of commentators around Europe, is the Algerians are basically wasting their time going to Brazil, that it's going to be a fight between the Belgians, the Russians, and the South Koreans for two places. And it's inevitable that the Algerians will prop up the table in fourth position. I beg to differ, particularly if the Algerians can avoid defeat in their first match against Belgium. I'm not saying they're going to qualify for the last 16, but they could well decide who does actually go through. A disappointing result, if you want to consider friendly seriously, maybe, is the fact that the Ivory Coast lost 2-1 to Bosnia. But again, I stress, let's not read too much into that. I think, by all accounts, the Ivorian preparations in the United States are going well. And then lastly, Sonny, Ghana, they went down 1-0 to the Netherlands. Now, nobody ever likes losing a match, but the Netherlands are a strong side. Remember, runners-up to Spain in 2010 World Cup. And certainly it was no disgrace to lose 1-0 in Rotterdam.
David, you mentioned Cameroon's 2-2 draw with Germany. Four-time African Footballer of the Year Samuel Eto'o had the first goal for the Indomitable Lions in that match. Do you get the feeling Eto'o is going to have a big World Cup in Brazil?
I sincerely hope so, Sonny. Samuel Eto'o certainly owes the people of Cameroon a good World Cup. Whatever he might say, and he can be quite a persuasive and dogmatic character at times, he was directly responsible for the disastrous showing in South Africa in 2010. Basically, the team was divided in two. There was those who supported Samuel Eto'o, and then there were those who supported the deposed captain, Rigobert Song. What happened is the French coach, Paul Again, he replaced Rigobert Song, the dreadlock centre-back who had been skipper of the Indomitable Lions for so long, with Samuel Eto'o. And this seemed to split the squad right down the middle. Eto'o, for all his skills, for all his talent, for all his ability, and for all his goals, and for all his exploits in Europe, at times I wonder if he has been a friend or a foe of the Indomitable Lions. As much as he does a lot of good, he also seems to cause a lot of harm. And I think he must now stop talking and just do the talking with his boots on the field. Yes, Sonny, we're really looking forward to a good World Cup from Samuel Eto'o. He's had a few digs at Jose Mourinho recently. He's called him a puppet. He's called him a fool. And my advice to Samuel Eto'o now is shut up and get on with scoring goals.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And speaking of South Africa, our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma caught up with a former world record-setting hurdler from South Africa and talked with him about how the country's athletic scene has changed with democracy and the end of apartheid. Here's Mark.
South Africa's most accomplished hurdler, Gert Potgieter, met the country's elite hurdlers at the University of Pretoria on Wednesday. A retired policeman, he set the world record in 440 yards hurdles three times between 1957 and 1960 and had these words of wisdom for his grandchildren in the event.
I'm so delighted that I've been part and parcel of the development of the high culture of performance here at the University of Pretoria. My whole idea today was to try to explain the importance of achievement, not to the expense, you know, of the materialistic things, or the expense of the mental mind. It should always be fair, and that it should be based on ethical codes, and that they should put their sights very high to try and achieve the best in the world.
You
took part, your pride, at a very different time in the 1950s, at the heart of apartheid when the country was segregated, and it also affected sports. In just a nutshell, what was the experience like then, which is different today?
Well, today we have the privilege to experience democracy. In my days, in the heart, there was no democracy. We lived separately, and there were laws, that prohibited us actually to mix socially. So the spontaneousness wasn't there. There wasn't much spontaneous mixing. And then I became very unpopular as I addressed all these irregularities in government. But today it's wonderful, to mix spontaneous, and that there's no discrimination, that we live in equal rights.
That was South Africa's herd porkita, former world record holder in 440 yards hurdles. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. Earlier, I mentioned Didier Drogba and Ivory Coast playing El Salvador this evening in a World Cup warm-up match in Texas. Following the game, El Salvador will travel here to the Washington area to take on reigning World Cup champion Spain on Saturday in another friendly international warm-up match. The game will be played at FedEx Field. The USA has been a popular destination for World Cup-bound teams. Before the World Cup officially kicks off next week, 15 of the 32 teams to qualify will have played a total of 20 friendly matches on American soil. The Chipolopolo of Zambia, the 2012 African champion in football, did not qualify for the World Cup. But the Zambians are also getting ready for a friendly here in the USA. The Chipolopolo will play Japan on Friday in the southern U.S. city of Tampa, Florida. If we stay in Florida and head northeast from Tampa to Jacksonville, that's where the Super Eagles of Nigeria will play the United States on Saturday. It'll be the last World Cup warm-up match for both teams before they pack their bags and head to Brazil. The Americans will kick off their World Cup campaign June 16th against Ghana. And yes, the Ghanaians will also play a World Cup warm-up match in Florida. The Black Stars of Ghana, quarterfinalists at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, will play South Korea on Monday in Miami, Florida. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Sunny like Florida. I'm VOA. Right. Yes, indeed. Florida sunshine. Back to Yahya's Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
All right. Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC. Right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up in our feature series, Poaching in Africa. And next, the plight of Zimbabwean refugees in South Africa. But first, some music. Here is HTO Asuka of Benin with Tanga.
Pas son abeille, venez le voir, nous avons tout en palais. Voyez-le, le daou blo blo de pam no son no mo glek benou asuka to pa voulait des sous son boudo roné ou tout o ada so wena chenou ko a mo wa wuzu dovo pourquoi quoi je na non non no ko ke mi na to wen dai ku pa no ho no ahun amoje ado to bu lo mo ko wa sa mi na mo ene a so we ka ik beto bo mi ko jo do mo ho jo ko fo me bombe oui me lo bono ju ji me a ti pa no gonu me a ti bulu to mo le ka lo meme yo vi mi to le neme
to pa mi to le neme
a mo e de fine ti yo maska jo nde bu na wane no sanu lo mo no me sanu lo bu no ke me me fika ko de yo nunde su do na wa so bu na te pa mo na ik beto su nu ko na do pe pa lo pa mo no pa mo no pa mo no ko fi se lo bono do ji me
tanga ma
do
go me
When they do me be say Nancy, we me in your way, son. But now when they know we bono as a two we. When they do me be say Nancy, we me say falling in gray, we bono way day. I can do we the obo, we bono as a two we. I say double no hati gibo kia kwek po an atena keo. Tagba de suwe anakye, bono fanu go quicky, but fin de fin. I go to men a gol no checky, but fin de fin. I go to men a gol no checky, in your way, son. But now when they know we do as a two we. When they do me be say Nancy, we me. H2O Asuka
Eventaki Akoche Eventaki Eventaki Akoche Eventaki Eventaki Akoche Eventaki
Nena wakobosu
Eventaki
Ahoye dukonu mi Akoche Eventaki
Eventaki
Nena wakobosu Ahoye dukonu mi
Eventaki
Akoche Eventaki
Benin's H2O Asuka with his hit song Tanga.
Wayahea's poaching of Africa's wildlife has become the realm of international crime syndicates that trade in diamonds, drugs, guns, and people. These global traders now buy elephant tusk and rhino horns from armed gangs that strike in any of 50 protected areas of Africa. So who are the poachers? William Eagle reports on the political who's who that are killing Africa's wildlife.
Many of the armed militias in Africa kill elephants and rhinoceros to raise money for their civil wars, attempted coups, cross-border strikes, and overall survival in the bush. The heads of government outside the continent now agree with African leaders and wildlife conservationists that it's time to take action. 50 heads of state were invited to London in April to stop the $20 billion illegal trade in wildlife. Who are these armed bands of rebels turned poachers? A Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, Brooke Darby, offers a few names.
There are indeed some links between terrorist groups as well as some of the criminal networks that are engaged in other types of criminal activity, whether it's narcotics trafficking or money laundering, what have you, who are also involved in the wildlife trade. Al-Shabaab, the Lord's Resistance Army, the Janjaweed, those are among the entities that we believe are involved in wildlife trafficking in some way or another.
Many rebel forces plunder herds easily within their reach, such as the rhinos and elephants that share their refuge in the jungles of Virunga National Park. But Sudan's infamous Janjaweed travel greater distances to slaughter elephants in Mali, says Patrick Bergen, chief executive officer of the African Wildlife Federation and a member of the President's Wildlife Task Force Advisory Council.
The situation that I'm thinking about is in northern Cameroon in a park there. The Janjaweed people on horseback and with arms going over state borders, moving between different countries, basically just sweeping into a park area and slaughtering tens or hundreds of elephants and collecting the ivory and being gone again like the wind.
The Janjaweed raids on Buba and Jida National Park have been going on for years, but with less killing than in the past, Bergen said.
This happened in the last 6 months, and it's not something that could happen very many times because the elephant population simply wouldn't sustain it. The elephant population is not that large to begin with.
John Calvelli of the Wildlife Conservation Society lists a relative newcomer to the wars of Central Africa, the mostly Muslim Seleka Force, under the leadership of Michel Djotodia. They overthrew the Central African Republic's president, François Bozizé, in Bangui, and held the country for about a year.
We've been working in CAR in Zangabai for over 20 years. One of our scientists has been embedded in that site monitoring this bay where literally hundreds of elephants come together. The Seleka Front was coming through this area, and our scientists had to be evacuated, and they killed over 26 elephants in the span of a couple of days. It would have been worse but for the actions taken by the Gabonese government and others to help stop that.
A major wave of poaching has been moving across Africa from west to east and north to south, says Calvelli. Humanitarian groups that track evidence of genocide by armed militias have also seen those trends.
The Enough Project sent two researchers in to the Garamba National Park in Congo to see how Joseph Kony, the large resistance army, was funding its activities. They came back, and their studies from June 3rd of 2013, they came back and said one of the ways that we have to stop Joseph Kony is by making the sale of ivory illegal.
The State Department's Darby says there is a lot about the dynamics of wildlife trafficking that authorities do not know for certain. However, she says there is good evidence pointing to the identity of the poachers.
There is actually some evidence of military elements from some countries being involved in this trade. It's discussed a little bit in the report that was prepared by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Dealing with the corruption side of the house is also something that we are focused on.
A former U.S. Justice Department prosecutor of many wildlife cases, John Webb, says the battle against Africa's poachers will have to be fought by the continent's national governments.
The overarching impediment to effective enforcement against poaching and trafficking is corruption. And that's the, and that is, you know, I don't, I'm going to make a bad joke here, but that's the elephant in the room.
Webb is also aware of the challenges for non-African governments. He's a member of the President's Advisory Council on Wildlife Trafficking with a long experience in interagency cooperation. It's not just a conflict between cops and criminals, he says. That's because, as Webb cautions, cops do not trust each other. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Thank you, Bill, for that report. And he has more on the new ivory war tomorrow. Tune in to discover the mercantile role of Somalia's al-Shabaab in the criminal network of the ivory trade.
Leading Zimbabwean refugee groups in South Africa have dismissed recent press reports that Zimbabweans living in that country will not be allowed to renew their permits when they expire in November. The South African government granted Zimbabweans living in that country a special dispensation some 4 years ago, allowing them to regularize their stay. Most of the permits that were obtained by more than 250,000 Zimbabweans are set to expire in November. Daniel Muzenda is...
We do not have an official communication.
Daniel Muzenda is communications director of the group Zim Migrants International. He tells reporter Chris Gandhi that at their last meeting with South African officials, it was agreed that a new directive would come from the new cabinet, which has not yet been sworn in.
We do not have an official communication from the South African government on the issue of permits. As from March, they haven't communicated to us any modalities. And as an organization, we have also partnered with some other organizations like the South African Forum for International Solidarity, and then Solidarity Peace Trust, and the African Diaspora Association to engage the government. We are also looking at other issues, not only the issue of permits, the delay in documentation processing leading to people losing their jobs here in South Africa. There is also rampant corruption in the Home Affairs Ministry and a lot of harassment of Zimbabweans especially by the South African police.
But why is it that the media is awash with news of the South African government having stopped issuing permits?
When I tried to find out from the Ministry of Home Affairs itself, there is nothing like that. As of now, the official position of the South African government, we are waiting for the modalities by the new minister who is going to be installed maybe in the next 2 weeks. So we are urging all our members not to panic and overreact and wait for the minister to give us the modalities, and then we will pick it up from there, Chris.
Communications Director Daniel Muzenda of Zim Migrants International. He was talking to reporter Chris Gandhi from Johannesburg. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the second half of the 20th century and into the third millennium, advocacy for democracy and respect for human rights have been central components of U.S. foreign policy. That's because not only does our support of democracy promote such fundamental American values as religious freedom and worker rights, but also because acting on behalf of human dignity is in our national interests, said President Barack Obama during a major policy speech at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, New York.
America's support for democracy and human rights goes beyond idealism. It is a matter of national security. Democracies are our closest friends and are far less likely to go to war. Economies based on free and open markets perform better and become markets for our goods. Respect for human rights is an antidote to instability and the grievances that fuel violence and terror.
Even though too many governments are still cracking down on civil society and are ever more tightly abridging their citizens' rights to freedom of speech and of peaceful assembly, more people live under elected governments today than at any time in human history, said President Obama. Even the upheaval of the Arab world reflects the rejection of an authoritarian order that was anything but stable, and now offers the long-term prospect of more responsive and effective governance, he said.
Ultimately, global leadership requires us to see the world as it is, with all its danger and uncertainty. We have to be prepared for the worst, prepared for every contingency. But American leadership also requires us to see the world as it should be, a place where the aspirations of individual human beings really matters, where hopes and not just fears govern, where the truths written into our founding documents can steer the currents of history in a direction of justice.
The question we face, said President Obama, is not whether America will lead, but how we will lead, not just to secure our peace and prosperity, but also extend peace and prosperity around the globe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story.
putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.